The other huge part of the GAS that, again, reaches right into Seattle and tells you what to do is the market access provisions. A former assistant to the U.S. Trade Representative says, the GATS article on market access extends beyond traditional concerns of access for foreign service suppliers to encompass all policies which restrict access to a market. This is a major, thank you for that, this is a major extension of multilateral trade disciplines into the realm of domestic policy. And this guy actually supports it, right? You know, he thinks this is good. But, you know, again, we have to listen to what these people are saying. He views the GATS negotiations as, I guess, an opportunity. We might see it as a threat to create a major extension of multilateral trade disciplines into the realm of domestic policy. Now, as an outside observer, it seems to me that one of the problems Americans are facing is not that they have an overregulated service sector. 74% of Americans work in the service sector, and that's partly because free trade has hammered you and made you lose a lot of manufacturing jobs. So again, when we're talking about the significance of services and going, oh, so what? What's a service? It's like dry cleaning. No, it's 74% of what people do for a living in the United States. And people who work in the service industry tend to work very long hours. They work beyond, because they're often not salaried employees. They often work at home. So a study that was recently published by the International Labor Organization showed that American workers are just completely overworked. People feel tired. There is a reason for that. American workers are just putting in huge, long hours, long work weeks. One-fifth of all Americans now work more than 49 hours a week. Okay. So this is a demand in the 19th century, you know, to get an 40-hour week, an 8-hour day. And we sort of retreated quite a bit from that. So now Americans are working 9 weeks longer annually on average than the average European worker. So that's, you know, you think about what you could do with 9 weeks over the year, you know, spend more time with your kids or whatever, get involved in more civic stuff. It's just horrendous. And in the American context, since 1979, American workers are working 2 months longer per year than they were doing in 1979. So one of the things that Americans identify when they say, you know, what's my biggest problem, they sometimes talk about what's happening to their families and the lack of time they have for their families. And you can see that this completely unregulated sector where people just work like dogs around the clock sometimes when they've got rush projects, maybe a cut in those hours that they have to work would be good, maybe some regulation. In France, for example, where productivity is actually higher than, the productivity gains in France are actually higher than in the United States, they're enforcing a 35-hour work week. I just think how nice that would be. anyway. So basically, again, to emphasize, you don't have to have any corporation banging at your door to have to reform your regulations if your government accepts to have your sectors covered by the GATS. That's why I think the name General Agreement on Trade and Services is so misleading. One of the articles under market access says that governments cannot discriminate against a service supplier on the basis of what kind of legal entity it is. Again, this is sort of the old boring trade language that puts everybody off. Well, what's an illegal entity? That's a public institution, or it's a wholly owned subsidiary from Germany, or it's a non-profit. Governments are not allowed under the GATS to make a distinction. So, subsidies are covered. give a subsidy to a library, can that be contested under the GATS? They apply this provision that you're not allowed to discriminate. And I love it when they borrow our language, they say discriminate is a bad thing. You know, giving preference to nonprofit institutions should not have a nasty word like discrimination attached to it. It should be something like promote or, you know, value public nonprofit institutions. But instead, we don't want to discriminate in favor of them. So subsidies are covered. Just, I don't know if people work for the public sector here, but, you know, think about your libraries and think about, any kind of public daycare, if you've got preferences for non-profit daycares, that kind of thing. Oh, yeah, that's a big one. I forgot about the judicial system. Okay. So here's another sort of concrete example of how the GATS would affect a specific sector. And in case, you know, I always have to, I've worked with these very, very good people within the British Columbia government, and they were sympathetic to making sure that people understood how bad things would be, but they also always warned me about being alarmist. You don't want to overstate your case. You want to be accurate in this stuff. But every time, you know, I think, well, maybe I'm being alarmist, I go and read the stuff on the World Trade Organization site. And it's just incredible. I mean, they will say just flat out that there's positive trends because things are being privatized. They just say that as though everyone is on board with this analysis. The WTO just last year put out a contract, on higher education. They led a contract to a private firm to do a study on higher education, and this firm just scoured the globe to find any example anywhere of a regulation or a measure that would impede trade in higher education. And the organization that they gave it to was something called the Global Alliance for Transnational Education. I always think of the Dave Barry term. I am not making this up, but I mean, it's just... So the Global Alliance for Transnational Education gets the study. It puts up on its website, I think it's still up there, asking people to send in email messages ratting on their own governments. Is there any example in your country of a restrictive practice that gives preference to local institutions? Right? And it tells people that they can do this anonymously, but reassures them that they are not committing treason by saying this. Again, I am not making this up. You can go to this website and read this tonight. Anyways, I guess some of us could dispute that, you know, when citizens are actively solicited to report on their own governments in favor of international corporations. So some examples of the nasty things he's looking for are laws limiting degrees to be conferred only by or through national universities. I don't know if that applies in the U.S. We'd have to talk about that later. Policies or laws discriminating against private institutions of higher education. So again, governments could not give a preferential subsidy to a public higher education institution or a college. And that would have huge ramifications in Canada. And policies which do not fully recognize foreign educational credentials. And again, you just have to sort of think through the implications of what that would mean in terms of American policy. So anyways, if the GATS is so bad, why haven't I heard about it? Okay, that's... if it's so alarming, you know, why don't we know? Well, you could say because the media will never tell you about it, but, you know, they didn't tell us about the MAI either. And there have been some disputes that have gone to the WTO under the Agreement on Trade and Services. One of them was the banana dispute. Anybody heard of that? Where the U.S., oh, this is a great crowd, the U.S. government on behalf of Chiquita and Del Monte challenged European efforts to promote banana growers in the Caribbean. That was the GATS dispute. The other one was our poor little attempt in Canada to preserve 3% of our magazine market for our own magazines. We're so pushy in Canada. We're just right out there. Anyways, that was struck down too, and that was under the General Agreement on Trade and Services. But now the ante is being upped in a massive, sweeping way. In order to get any agreement whatsoever, because understandably, a lot of countries that are only aspiring to have public services didn't want to sign an agreement on trade and services that would just preempt any hope they ever had towards industrialized nations kind of regulation and lifestyle and all the things that we enjoy. I mean, this would just cut it right off at the pass. So third world countries and developing nations in particular were very reluctant to sign. The U.S. got them to sign by saying, you just have to put forward the things you want to put forward. So a lot of people just put forward luxury hotels. They don't care about them. They could do whatever they want. So luxury hotels were covered. And they also said, you don't have to have the whole of the agreement apply. Even if you put forward something like luxury hotels, maybe you don't have one of the provisions apply, like foreign services, foreign service workers being able to work at the hotel. So it was very, very non-threatening for people to sign on to this thing and not worry about it. Well, now they're changing. They want to change the way the agreement is negotiated from this piecemeal thing where you put something in and you sort of take it back to putting everything, all 160 sectors, on the table at the same time. Okay? I'm going to give you a quote from a guy who actually has a pivotal role in coming up with the draft agreements for this kind of stuff. His name's Rolf Adlon. He works for the WTO Services Division. And what he says about how great it would be just to put everything on the table at the same time is he says, in particular, it could help to include countries, measures and sectors which, reflecting lack of interest on the part of the larger players, have hitherto eluded, have hitherto eluded significant reform, or at least bindings. The onus would be on the domestic interest group seeking to avoid liberalization, thus reducing the burdens on administrations to cajole them into participation. See how efficient this is, you know? Basically, this might prove particularly difficult in areas such as health and education. And again, I'm not making this up. I can send you the paper where he said this. So you can see how efficient a change in the negotiating from just putting one thing forward at a time, each country doing that, to putting all the 160 sectors on the table at once. Rather than politicians having to muck around and actually consult with people and consult with sectors and the general public about whether a particular service should be subjected to the GATS, you get all sectors on the table at once, and then groups and countries have to scramble to get services they care about protected. Since there are 160 sectors potentially covered by the agreement, everything from park maintenance to university education to sewer and water services, everything being up for grabs at once would be a monumental challenge to groups and unions trying to protect the public interest. Now, Adlon borrows a very interesting image. Ulysses tying himself to the mast to avoid being called off course by the sirens. Okay? Now, this is... a WTO official is saying the good thing about the GATS is that Like the Ulysses myth, and maybe I'll just explain that a bit for those of you who slept through classical Greek mythology in high school. This is one of the trials of Ulysses, right? He's going back, he's sailing, trying to get home to Ithaca after he's finished sacking Troy, which was the city, not the Star Trek character. Okay. So anyways, he's on his way and he faces a whole bunch of different trials and tribulations. One of them is he has to pass the island where the sirens live. And the sirens are sea nymphs, and they sing so sweetly that they draw sailors off course and they founder on the rocks. Okay. So Ulysses' task was, how do I pass the sirens without going off course and having my ship break up and everything, everybody die? So the solution was, he had his crew bind him to the mast of his ship, and his crew stopped their ears with beeswax, okay, so they couldn't hear the call of the sirens. Now, this is the analogy that a top WTO official says is what the advantage of the WTO is. He says that governments are like Ulysses, being bound to the mast of the ship of state so that they can avoid hearing what he calls the interest groups from citizens calling him off course, calling these governments off course. Okay? I just find it an absolutely astonishing anti-democratic image. He even says later on in his paper that sometimes governments sign things, and I had an interesting talk with Maria just before we began, sometimes governments sign things and they don't understand the full implications. They don't understand how strong the bindings are going to be. Well, Mr. Adlung thinks this is a good thing, because sometimes WTO unelected, secretive dispute panels interpret these agreements far beyond what the elected representatives of governments intended. He thinks this is a good thing. These are the people who work for the World Trade Organization. If you think you're going to get justice for labor or for the environment out of these people, I think you're looking in the wrong place. But let's look at this image from a democratic perspective. Politicians are allowing themselves to be bound, and they actually use this language in trade circles. These are bindings. Governments are going to be disciplined. It all sounds sort of sadomasochistic, actually. There's a clause in the GATS called the gods, and you're actually supposed to follow the disciplines under the gods. You know, it's all. I mean, it would be hard to satirize if it wasn't true. So you have these bindings where politicians are not supposed to, and they call us interest groups, you know. Labor, the environment, we're all interest groups that call governments off course. So in other words, citizens. The citizens are calling governments off course. We're not even considered to be on the ship of state. We're on this island. We are like the other. If people have studied literary theory, we're like the other. We're faceless. We're dangerous. We're calling governments off course to their deaths. And the only thing governments can do, not to respond to our sweet songs, and maybe these are sweet songs about universal health care, maybe they're sweet songs about good public services or more equality and more justice, but governments are bound by the WTO not to listen to us. And then we can look at the crew. Anybody got some ideas about who the crew might be? This is actually a really good tool for workshops, and I brought copies with me. People want to use it. Again, there's no intellectual property rights on this stuff. So who could the crew be? Maybe the crew... Well, they usually don't work. They don't do the work. Other people do the work, like Nike. Charlene Brzezinski, trade representatives, like,
U.S.
Army. Yeah. You could think of these this crew that has stopped up its ears not to listen to us as being the people who are supposed to be representing us at these trade negotiations. It would be Charlene Brzezinski for you, Leon Britton for the Europeans, and our guy, Sergio Marchi, for Canadians. So they're rowing away and they're not listening to us, right? And they've bound our political leaders with these trade agreements. So no matter what kind of sweet, enticing songs we're singing, they're not going to listen to us. And so they've got their ears blocked with beeswax, which you know might be neoliberal ideology, maybe. You can just sort of, there's lots of things you can do with this image. And maybe the image, rather than the way Adlung uses it, we can start sort of looking at it as what the challenge is before us. That we need people to represent us at these trade negotiations who will truly listen to us and represent our interests, or maybe we'll stop the boat. And maybe we need to elect politicians who are not eager to be bound up in this way and who are actually interested in governing. Well, that's a concept, eh? Maybe then we could see the ship of state heading in the direction of the public interest.
Take questions right now for Ellen, just to keep this conversation going about 15 minutes. There's a microphone over here.
Right. Okay. This is called, they have a whole unit called the Dispute Settlement Unit. The WTO cannot rewrite your laws. I'll say that right up front. They cannot go to the Congress and go, paragraph 6 has to be changed. They don't do that. What they say is, if you want to continue to have this thing, once it's been challenged, and some other country has to challenge it, right? Like under the Clean Air Act, it's challenged by Venezuela. The American Clean Air Act was challenged by Venezuela because they wanted to keep exporting polluting gas to you. So your Clean Air Act was challenged. It was not struck down. The WTO didn't say you have to change it in this or that way. They just said, sure, you can have it, but you have to pay hundreds of millions of dollars every year you keep the regulation in place. So you don't pay. The other thing that they can do is all U.S. exports, and this is probably the more heavy-duty one, okay? Venezuela, I don't know what Venezuela imports from you, but say Europe. Europe could say, okay, we're going to put 100% duty on U.S. steel. And what would U.S. steel say to the American government? Change your regulation now. And they do. They have it every single case. Every single country has buckled because it would mean that they would have a whole bunch of domestic industries on their case. And also, what country can afford to pay, even big guys like you guys, can you afford to pay hundreds of millions of dollars to keep your regulations in force? So, I mean, ideally, you could say governments could say no. They just never do. This is WTO sanctioned. This is the whole thing about it being a rules-governed environment. What they often argue is that the WTO is good because it's rules and it's, you know, not the big guys beating up on the little guys, but everybody agrees to play by the same rules. If you withdraw from that club, you're not protected by the rules and everybody can have at you, right? And that's a very vulnerable position, and that's why they can coerce everybody to stay inside and not challenge a WTO ruling. Actually, Europe is challenging. Do people know about the beef hormone? This is the most incredible case. 90% of North American beef, and I'll talk about Canadian beef so you don't feel sensitive about it. 90% of Canadian beef is laced with hormones. I think about 4 months ago, the European Union had a scientific panel report that said it in a wonderful sort of translation from the French kind of way, that the beef hormones that are being used are a complete and total carcinogen. Okay? So if you have beef in your fridge right now, I don't know. I mean, I threw mine out after reading this European report. The only way this whole story got reported in Canada was that we weren't going to be able to import Werther's gumdrops. You know, when everything is seen through a trade lens, it just becomes a very bizarre world. We didn't get a headline, even a dismissive one, saying Europeans are saying, even though they're lying, that hormone-treated beef is carcinogenic. Even if they dismissed it, but that's not how the story was reported. It was reported in the business pages, and you got to like paragraph number 19, and that's where it said, and the Europeans have a scientific report saying that all hormone-treated beef is carcinogenic. So it's just, in terms of your values in a society, do we value human health? Do we value the precautionary principle? No. We value trade and, you know, whether or not we can get Werther's chocolates and things like that. I mean, it was a bizarre story. I mean, the specifics of this study, which are available on the European Union's website, are worth reading because they investigated the veterinary practices of Canadian beef farmers and found, you know, they're supposed to put the hormone in the ear so that that's not used in a place where people normally get cuts of meat, and they find that they inject the hormones wherever. It's totally unregulated. You can be getting a cut of beef, and it can be where the hormone is injected. And they did a study on baby food. I won't mention the brand name just in case, but they did a study of baby food, and they found that there was just massive, massive amounts of hormone way beyond what children should be consuming. Why wasn't it a story in North America? Anyways, Europeans are taking this on. It's the first time. They're going to take the sanctions. They're going to...